Hi, welcome back to the program. I'm your host, Betsy Rosenberg, and I am very pleased and honored to welcome my next guest to the show. Reverend Fred Small has been a religious leader for many, many years, and I've been aware of his involvement in trying to rally the religious community around climate action for at least 5 years, maybe longer. I'm not sure if he's been with us on the program, either this one. I don't think it was this one. It might have been EcoTalk on Air America. So maybe he remembers. And if not, great to finally have you on. Reverend Small, thanks for taking the time to join us on your birthday, no less.
Thank you so much, Betsy. It is my birthday, and, you know, I celebrate so much. I'm looking out the window at the fall leaves and the trees. My office at church looks out over a burial ground, actually, and you know, it's a wonderful image of the paradox that we face. You know, the world is so beautiful and so precious and so exquisite, and people are so wonderful and good, and at the same time, we are in such terrible peril from our own short-sightedness and too often greed.
Perfectly said, and I don't know if you heard us talking a few minutes ago. David Suzuki, of course, the great Canadian activist and author and speaker, just did a manifesto saying that same thing, that as he gets on in his life, he has nothing to, you know, no stake to make, no particular axe to grind. He just is very concerned about the future we're leaving our children and how he has, you know, fought the good fight, but he's not very encouraged. We're not going in the right direction, and I think he's filing some kind of legal action against the Canadian government. I'm going to try to find out more and do something on that next week. But he said, just as you did, that this dichotomy between the exquisite beauty and intricacy and miracles of nature, and how in just one or two generations we seem to be messing with Mother Nature in a way that could cause permanent harm. And, you know, while we all are so busy to the point of distraction that we can't, you know, really rally the masses to, as I say, wake up and smell the carbon, to take action. So we certainly agree with what you're saying. Tell us what kind of action you've taken to the point of even taking part in a protest against your Boston station with D.R. Tucker and some others from Forecast the Facts. I guess that was
the
WGBH rally.
My activism on this matter goes back decades, really ever since I read The End of Nature by Bill McKibben in 1989.
I thought it had been decades. I've been reading about you. I didn't want to misspeak, but I have been aware. So go ahead. Yes, tell us.
Well, I was really honored to be one of the first people arrested in the United States in civil disobedience on the subject of climate change. I was one of the leaders of an action coordinated by Religious Witness for the Earth in Washington, D.C. in early 2001. We were arrested outside the Department of Energy building, protesting both plans to drill in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, but also the obvious opposition of the then very early George W. Bush administration to any action on climate. He had promised, you may recall, as a candidate, to regulate carbon as a pollutant, and that was the very first campaign promise that President George W. Bush broke once he was elected. So we sat in front of the building. We were singing and praying and we went to jail briefly, fortunately. But I do this, you know, not out of any sense of grandiosity or grandstanding, but because I do feel that climate is a moral issue. Every religion, every ethical system forbids theft, and global warming is theft. It's theft from our own children and right now from the most vulnerable people on the planet, most of them poor and of color, the people Jesus called the least of these. So I am, you know, I have many privileges in my life, I am spending those privileges to the extent that I can to try to raise a religious voice and a moral voice, saying we've got to do something about it.
And you were in particular protesting the station, I believe, because one or more of the Koch brothers is represented on the board?
Yes, David Koch is a board member at WGBH. I have nothing against David Koch personally, but of course David Koch and his brother are not just individual citizens like you and I, you and me, writing letters to the editor and standing on a street corner exercising our First Amendment rights. When David Koch wants to champion a point of view, his voice is amplified many, many times beyond what you or I could muster. And I think I think the Koch brothers' influence on our democracy is very troubling. But more specifically, around the issue of climate, it is a moral issue. I don't impose any political litmus test on the board of WGBH, but I do impose a moral litmus test. I was trying to think of an analogy that would really fit, and any analogy is, you know, has its limits. But I thought of this analogy. It's as if we're on an ocean liner, and an iceberg has smashed a huge hole in the hull, and water is rushing in below decks. Now, someone discovers the hole and dashes to the deck to warn the passengers. But there are the Koch brothers, standing on deck, reassuring everyone, saying, there's no way there could be a hole. Or if there could, the crew already has it under control, and, you know, there's no need to interrupt cocktails and dinner.
And when someone happened with that giant cruise ship off the coast of Italy, when they were denying it as they went down, you know?
Yeah, exactly. And so David Koch prevents any, investigation of the situation, saying, don't worry about it, you know, have a drink, enjoy dinner. And knowing all the time that there's a helicopter on its way to pick him and his brother off the deck and fly them to safety. Of course, there's not room in the helicopter for anyone else, and the reason for the deception is that the Koch brothers are major investors in the firm that designed the hull.
Mm.
So
that's
a moral issue. That's not, well, you know, let's, you know, we can disagree and, you know, let's look at the science and let's have a good discussion about it. That's abuse of power, and that's what concerns me.
And I bet, like Reverend Sally Bingham, perhaps your counterpart here on the West Coast and a longtime friend of mine, I'm proud to say.
Well, Sally was arrested with us in 2001 in that same event, so I'm a big fan of Sally's.
That's right. I think she and I were sharing office space in the Presidio at the time, so I think that is how I first came to know about your commitment to this effort as well. You know, she preaches what she practices. Do you also, in your congregation, the First Parish in Cambridge, I guess it's a Unitarian Universalist Church, is that correct?
That's right.
And what kind of response do you get? And is this something you've been doing, you know, for more than a decade or only recently? Or do you somehow keep it separate from what you give your sermons about? I don't think that's the case. I can't imagine. Sally certainly doesn't.
No, I've been serving this church now for just over 5 years, and they knew who I was when they called me, and they were, you know, they were particularly seeking someone who would be a leader in not only environmental justice but social justice, racial justice. And I, you know, it's not as if I, every Sunday I stand in the pulpit with a placard. You know, people need spiritual nurture, and I spend a lot of my time not only crafting and supporting worship that I hope is spiritually grounded and spiritually deep, but of course, you know, pastoral care, just taking care of people, just ordinary, everyday suffering. And ordinary everyday joy and celebration. It's actually, I think it helps sustain me as an activist because, my God, if I were a full-time political activist on climate for the last 20 years, I'd be pretty depressed right now. I can come back to my congregation and nourish and be nourished by just the regular humanity of ordinary people living their lives.
Hmm. So having covered the Green Beat for about 15 years now, I started out with Trash Talk covering garbage and then following the waste stream all the way to our emissions and what's coming out of our tailpipes to mostly focus on global warming now called climate change. I have been aware of the early adopters in the religious community, the Bill McKibbins, the Sally Binghams, even Dr. Catherine Hayhoe, the fabulous atmospheric scientist, you know, is an evangelical along with her husband, and they speak in their community about the need to get, you know, religious people on board this effort. And where has it gone over the last 10 to 15 years? And I guess it's probably been about a decade that I've been aware of people like Reverend Bingham in the Episcopalian Church speaking out and others like yourselves. I mean, has it progressed? Has it grown? Or is it still pretty stagnant in terms of, you know, numbers of, you know, people being pulled into the tent willingly or otherwise? Just trying to get a snapshot of where the movement is at this point, if you have a sense of that.
Well, I guess as someone who grew up I was born in 1952, so I really imprinted on the civil rights movement, and was I think really forever changed by the news footage I saw from the Birmingham demonstration, where these young kids were set upon by police dogs and fire hoses, and I think that actually helped me see the world in moral terms. Looking at the leadership of churches and religious folk during that era, you know, I have to say that, goodness, the faith community is woefully underperforming right now. It is a sleeping giant. I think if people of faith were really roused to action, we could make a huge difference. You're quite right. There have been leaders, individual people, individual congregations. There have been wonderful declarations of concern by religious leaders, but there's been no mobilization, no mass mobilization of religious people on this issue.
And of course, with the success of the Interfaith Power and Light group that Sally Bingham started, I probably should have her on and ask her directly, but it seemed like there was some momentum for a while.
Well, the bottom line for me, Betsy, is when are we going to put a price on carbon? Mm-hmm. Until we do that, everything we do as individuals, in our own homes, even as greening our congregations so that we're better stewards of energy and resources, all of those are just really trivial. I mean, they change minds, they change hearts, and that's good. But those changed minds and hearts, it seems to me, then have to be involved. Be active and proactive in the halls of Congress and in our legislatures, and if necessary on the streets. Otherwise, it will be too little, too late.
Mm. And what do you think when you see? You know, we have a steady stream of reports coming from all kinds of sources. Over the weekend, there was a report about how, you know, we will see more violence and sickness.
Yes.
You know, due to more drought spreading across, and it's always the most vulnerable who are hit first. And then the BBC just came out with something: concentrations of warming gases break record for 2012. That, according to the World Meteorological Organization, CO2 growing more rapidly last year than its average rise over the past decade. Concentrations of methane and nitrous oxide also breaking previous records. Have we gotten immune to this, or have we just not heard enough? I'm talking about the American public, since we do talk a lot in this program about, you know, how much more the media could be doing, should be doing. It sometimes seems like it's a lack of information, and sometimes it seems like it's information overload. Just wondered what your sense of that is, and how important is inspiration in that equation, or motivation?
Sure.
Not
well,
feel that, overwhelmed that, and paralyzed and ope too late.
Yeah, well, that's a very powerful question and a crucial question. I think the first thing I should note is that is it too much or too little information? I think we really need to pay attention to the disinformation campaign waged, unfortunately, by people like the Koch brothers. There are a lot of very powerful, very well-financed interests with investments in the status quo that don't want to change, that are making good money off of fossil fuels, and they have quite deliberately and intentionally and effectively confused and distracted the public, and confused them by suggesting that there is a serious disagreement about the science of climate change. There are certainly dissenters who I believe are sincere. There are dissenters who are sincere who are also heavily funded by the fossil fuel industry. And the truth is that the consensus on the reality and the dangers of climate change is overwhelming. Certainly, far beyond the point where we should be acting dramatically to remedy it. Now, the question of what kind of information and how do people respond? Goodness, you know, if I knew the answer to that, I would be a lot more effective than I am. On the one hand, you know, we hear from psychologists that you know, too much negativity, too much negative information is not empowering. We're told, well, you ought to provide solutions at the same time, which I think is fair. I think it was President Garfield, of all people, who uttered one of my favorite quotes of all time: "The truth will set you free, but first it will make you miserable." And in a way, we're not miserable
enough. That's a good one.
we're not miserable enough yet. You know, I was a teenager during the Vietnam War era, and of course, when kids got active was when their brothers, mostly then, were coming home in body bags. And we don't have the body bags in front of us, and when we do, we aren't able to make the connection convincingly enough. When people are killed by these extreme weather events, it's true. Scientifically, we can't say, okay, this particular storm was caused by climate change. But the trend is absolutely undeniable. And I'm afraid that our political system, so beholden to moneyed interests, the more so, you know, with recent Supreme Court decisions like Citizens United, that we're facing a stacked deck and an uneven playing field. And I do think we will suffer greatly. But, you know, we've been suffering in different ways for a long time, different folks, differentially. And so suffering is not new. What we need, and this gets to your spiritual question, what we need, I believe, is love and compassion and an understanding of our interconnectedness, and that is what's going to carry us through.
And for the Koch brothers to die off, not that I'm wishing anyone ill will, but, I mean, they really have had so much power, and it's gone on so long, and undue influence and all that. One can't help but wonder a couple things. You know, what religion are they? How much money do they need? You know, how do they view their children and grandchildren and beyond their future? You know, why does that seem to not matter? I mean, I've said this before. It just makes me craziest when we have so much work to do without any interference like that, without, you know, a massive, well-funded, you know, effort to obscure the facts. When you add that into the mix, it really is enough to make those of us who are, you know, most committed to change, you know, want to pull our hair out or scream or worse.
Indeed, and I see my job as a pastor partly to offer not only hope, but a kind of equanimity, so that even as we face these very desperate realities, we can do so with as much kindness as we can muster, and to treat each other well, and even to treat our opponents well, because that was essential to Dr. King's method and message. And you know, if we turn as mean as the times may challenge us to be, we will, you know, dishonor ourselves, and the suffering will not actually be ameliorated by that.
It's really kind of an existential conundrum, isn't it? On
it
the one
is.
Hand, love is all we need. It's all that matters. It's all that will get us through. And yet sometimes it feels like we activists, and I mean that in a broad sense on many issues, but particularly the environment and climate, since many of these problems that we are creating ourselves are not going to be reversible if they can be slowed, that we need to make more noise, to raise the urgency level and volume more so. I know I've personally just gone back and forth so many times, you know, should we be more patient or more persistent? Should we?
Well, and I would say both.
Radical activism or, you know, what? What will it take? What are the solutions?
Yeah. Well, I have several spiritual guides. One is Jesus, who talked of turning the other cheek and giving away one's cloak. And he also, you know, overturned the tables in the temple. So he could act in love and anger at the same time. And more contemporaneously, Thich Nhat Hanh, the Buddhist teacher, he's a you know, has been a peace activist for decades, and he really embodies such serenity in it all. In other words, that one can be both, that one can tend to one's own soul, which we never want to forfeit, but also wade into the fray of political conflict and do what has to be done.
Well, Reverend Fred Small, I want to thank you for your commitment, your work. I want to wish you many, many more happy birthdays and healthy years ahead. Hearing you with your commitment, which is, you know, stretched out over the decades, as you said, and your sensibility and your intelligence and just unwavering commitment to this cause gives me hope.
Well, thank you, Betsy. It's been a pleasure and a wonderful birthday gift to me.
Okay. Well, go out and enjoy it because life is a gift, and that's really what it comes down to. Let's not screw it up because however we got here, it's too precious to mess with, and I guess that's probably a good place to end this edition of The Green Front. Thanks so much, Reverend Small. And that does it for this edition of the program. If you have joined us in progress, we've been speaking with Reverend Fred Small. He is a senior minister with a church in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and he has done a lot of great work on the climate and environmental front and working with religious congregations and trying to bring more members into this effort to save our planet, save our home. And the entire interview can be heard on PRN.fm and later posted at The Green Front. That does it for this program. I want to welcome you back next week. We'll be covering some of the stories we touched upon today and have more great green guests for you. Have a great week.
But we can turn it around if we just come together. We can turn it around.